I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Governor Rick Scott says rejecting high-speed rail in Florida was the right decision after new numbers came out last week showing a big markup in the cost of California's high-speed train. We'll get the latest from Transportation Nation reporter Matt Dellinger. Plus, renowned wilderness photographer Clyde Butcher, in his own words, and an update on concerns over a new wilderness preserve intended to protect the headwaters of the Everglades. And what happens when elementary school teacher Miss Nelson goes missing? We'll talk with actors from Orlando's Shakespeare Theater. First, though, a look at high-speed rail ahead on Intersection. Just when you thought the high-speed rail issue in Florida was dead, it comes back faster than a maglev out of Shanghai. Governor Rick Scott last week took quick note of projected cost increases in California's high-speed rail project. Scott used the opportunity to boost his decision to reject billions in federal money earlier this year that would have launched Florida's high-speed rail hopes. Here to talk about it online from his home in Brooklyn is Matt Dellinger, writer for TransportationNation.org, a national reporting project which WMFE is also a member of. He also is author of Interstate 69, The Unfinished History of the Last Great American Highway. Matt, good to talk with you.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So Florida Governor Rick Scott jumped back into the high-speed rail fray when he saw the latest numbers on high-speed rail in California. And this really sounded like an I-told-you-so moment from the Florida governor. What was the reaction around the country to that statement?
Well, a lot of people, you know, people who are kinder to high-speed rail and think more highly of it, took Governor Scott's statements as sort of political opportunism, and because there's really major differences between what's going on in California and what happened in Florida, and the governor doesn't have quite as much room to gloat, I think, as he'd like. What you saw in California, that the price increases there had a lot to do with making it more palatable to the communities it was going to pass through. If you look at the reasons for the cost increases, a lot of it is they're building more tunnels, they're building more viaducts to kind of get this away from at grade and make sure that it doesn't divide communities. And it's sort of, the price increase was, it was big, but it wasn't beyond what people were guessing anyway was going to be the real cost of this thing. You often see cost increases, and they're not always this big, but, you know, they expressed reasons for them, and it all made sense.
And, Matt, you know, 2 years ago, there were a number of high-speed rail projects on the table across the United States, but that has been substantially whittled down as various governors have decided not to pursue those projects, including Florida. So at this point, who's left standing, really, in producing a viable high-speed rail network, and how close is that to being able to actually carry passengers?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that the Florida corridor is quite as dead as the governor would like it to be. It might be just dormant and waiting for him to go away. you may see it rear its head again, because that the right-of-way is still owned and there's still interest from Disney and other major companies and other companies, you know, international companies who want to build and operate it. The two places that are moving the most are California and New York.
Well, we'll have to keep an eye on it and see how quickly it actually comes to fruition. That's writer and reporter Matt Dellinger of TransportationNation.org, national reporting project based at WNYC in New York. He was speaking to us from his home in Brooklyn. Matt's also author of Interstate 69, The Unfinished History of the Last Great American Highway. Matt, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Up next, photographer Clyde Butcher in his own words. This is Intersection. Photographer Clyde Butcher is known for amazing black-and-white photographs of wild Florida, particularly the Everglades. His work is often compared to the imagery of Ansel Adams. Butcher's son was killed in a car crash with a drunk driver, and after the tragedy, Butcher retreated into the Florida wilderness to pursue his pictures. Recently, Intersection assistant producer Amy Green joined Clyde Butcher and a group of environmental experts, journalists, and federal officials at a conference on the Everglades in South Florida. She assembled this audio portrait of photographer Clyde Butcher in his own words.
My name is Clyde Butcher. I'm a photographer, and we have a gallery in the Big Cypress National Preserve. Our son was killed in a drunk driving incident where a drunk driver hit their car. I've been doing color photography in California and here. Actually, I started black and white back in the 50s and 60s. And I had been doing art shows, and people were getting really excited. They saw this work, and they thought, is this Africa? Oh, it must be the Amazon. I said, no, it's South Florida. Really? These are people living in Florida. They don't know Florida. So people were getting really excited about the work, but I just felt that there wasn't the color. It was so much color, you couldn't see the subject matter. I wanted to make a living, so color photography was selling, black and white wasn't. So I did the color for a couple of years, and then I was thinking, I think I need to go back to black and white. I think black and white will give the essence of the Everglades because you're confusing the color. And then at the same time, my son was killed, and I decided that I'm going to do what I think is right, whether it's commercially viable or not. It's what I need to do. We only have one life to live, and you have to do what you think. And I just took all my color work to the dump. My friends said, you're crazy, man. And I watched the machine run over all about $400,000 worth of pictures. And got my 8x10 and got out in the woods. And some of my best pictures were taken that summer after Ted was killed. The TV industry and the movie industry has done a great thing on the snakes and gators. Now, most snake bites probably happen getting in your car. You step on one, it's underneath your car. Gators, where they're dangerous, is with golf courses, where people are. Where we went, there are no people. The gators are scared to death of you. And snakes, we don't take people out mating season. The snakes are very aggressive during May and April, so we don't take people out in April and May and June. So once you understand the environment a little bit, it's very, very... The best time is August, September, October. Morning's my favorite time. I like to try to get out at least a half an hour to an hour before sunrise. There's no movement. Everything's still, perfectly still. The water is crystal still. Just sometimes it's moving south a little bit, but nothing's moving. A lot of my images require that because they're long exposures. They take 5 to 6, 10 minutes to expose a sheet of film. It's just downright gorgeous. It's you're coming along to the open prairies, and you get into these little womb places where the sun comes sparkling through and hits bromelias and hits. See how that clear water hits the grass under the water. Everglades is obviously, this is a place where there's no other place like it in the world. I mean, you can go to the Rocky Mountains, or you can go to Switzerland, or you can go to the Andes. You can see the Rocky Mountains anywhere. Might be the only thing you can't see anywhere, the redwood forest. But this is a special place. People don't realize how special it is here in Florida. You know, it's just a big old swamp. But once you take a walk and get into the heart of it, you'll discover it's a gorgeous, primitive, primeval place where you can figure a dinosaur is coming over the mountain any time.
That was photographer Clyde Butcher. Intersection assistant producer Amy Green put together that interview with Clyde Butcher when she was on a tour of the Big Cypress National Preserve with a group of journalists and other Everglades experts. Amy Green is working on a book about the Everglades and is with me to discuss Clyde Butcher and Everglades restoration. Amy, we just heard Clyde Butcher talking about the Everglades, which have been the subject of his famous photographs for decades. What was your impression of Clyde Butcher the man, and why is he considered such a character in the story of the Everglades?
He just is someone who loves the Everglades and loves the environment. My impression is that he just enjoys nothing more than sharing that with other people. If you can imagine how he looks, the day that I was with him, he has a gray beard. He was wearing kind of a tattered straw hat to keep the sun out and swamp clothes. And he just, his manner was very warm, and very welcoming into the swamp, which he realizes is a place where not a lot of people want to go.
So if we listen to this, this is the sound of you actually on a swamp slog with Clyde Butcher. How deep in the water are you, and what did you experience as you're going through this?
The deepest that I got was about hip deep. And it wasn't what I expected. It wasn't the first time I had been in the Everglades. I had been in the Everglades a couple years ago with my husband on vacation, but that was my first time in the water. And the first thing that I said when I kind of stepped off dry land and got into the water was, this is so cool. The water is not dirty. I was ready for just very thick, dense mud, you know, kind of sucking the shoe off your foot, dense mud. And it wasn't like that at all. The water was very clear. It seemed very clean. It's brown because of the tannins in the water, but it's clear. You can see to the bottom as long as your feet are not stirring things up. Clyde himself told us that sometimes he will drink right out of the swamp. I don't know if I would do that. But the weather was Chamber of Commerce. A lot of rain had just gone through, and so there were no mosquitoes. And it was a great experience.
Now, the Everglades are subject to one of the world's largest environmental restoration efforts, expected to cost the state of Florida and the federal government about $13 billion. The Everglades start near our listener region in central Florida, move through south Florida, out into the Gulf of Mexico and Florida Bay. Projects to restore them have been going on for decades. So why are the Everglades still considered to be so crucial both for the nation and the state of Florida?
Well, in response to the economic condition of the country, environmentalists you're seeing environmentalists trying to put a dollar amount on the economic impact of the Everglades. And this winter, the Everglades Foundation actually commissioned a study putting a dollar amount on the economic impact of the Everglades. The study looked at jobs created, tourism, property values, and that is a response to an economic climate and a political climate where you're seeing a lot of cutting. When I was in South Florida, I interviewed U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar. He talked about that.
If we don't do these kinds of projects now, we're going to create huge economic problems for our future. If you don't have a good, stable water supply in South Florida, it's going to create major problems economically for this state. And this state is so big, that means problems for the rest of the country as well. And in addition to that, the millions of visitors that come here to South Florida to visit places like Big Cypress and the Everglades, you know, they dump a lot of money as tourists coming into this area. And so that's why these kinds of investments are good for the sustainability of the economy long term.
That was U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar. And that was I was talking with him along Tamiami Trail in South Florida, at a place where they're actually building a bridge. They're going to bridge Tamiami Trail so that the water of the Everglades can flow more naturally through South Florida.
We're talking with assistant producer of Intersection, Amy Green. She's also an environmental journalist and was recently down in the Everglades with photographer Clyde Butcher on a slog through the swamp down there. Now, earlier this year, the federal government announced plans for a new wildlife refuge that would protect the headwaters of the Everglades right near Kissimmee. So what is the goal of that project?
The goal of that project is to include water or to improve water quality flowing from Central Florida into South Florida. At the heart of the Everglades is water. Water is what is needed by the Everglades to improve the condition of the Everglades. Water is needed, of course, by the urban areas, Orlando, you know, Fort Lauderdale, Miami, Palm Beach, and also for agriculture growers who are south of Lake Okeechobee. And so that's kind of the point of contention when it comes to the Everglades, is that water supply. And so the Headwaters effort is about improving the quality of water flowing from Central Florida into South Florida. Now, there's some controversy when it comes to this Headwaters effort, and there are some people who are concerned about this land being within federal ownership. And as a matter of fact, when I was in South Florida, the subject came up. There is a lawsuit underway in the Big Cypress National Preserve aiming to curb off-road vehicle use within Big Cypress National Preserve. And some people were talking about what the ramifications of that lawsuit might be for the Headwaters effort here in Central Florida. One person I spoke to was Joe Browder, a longtime Everglades activist.
They have the hunters feeling so betrayed that the hunters may kill this effort that could get another 300,000 or 400,000 acres of Everglades land protected up in the Kissimmee and northern parts of the Big Cypress. So that's the real Everglades story that's going on now, with a sort of old-fashioned war against having non-traditional uses in the National Park System unit spill over and cost us the most important opportunity to protect the Everglades we've had since the park was established and since Big Cypress got put in.
That was Joe Browder, a longtime Everglades activist. Now, the people behind the legal action in Big Cypress National Preserve say they are supportive of hunters and they're supportive of recreational use of protected lands. And I talked to John Adornato, Suncoast Regional Director for the National Parks Conservation Association, which is the organization behind the legal action in Big Cypress National Preserve. And he talked to me about how preserves and refuges are different classifications of federally protected lands.
Most often, national wildlife refuges are specifically created to allow for extractive uses. National wildlife refuges are specifically created to allow for hunting and fishing in some cases. So if the Fish and Wildlife Service is very clear in their proposed management for the Everglades Headwaters National Wildlife Refuge, then I think we can avoid some of these problems that were left vague in the creation of the Big Cypress National Preserve.
That was John Adornato, Suncoast Regional Director of the National Parks Conservation Association.
Is it unusual to hear this kind of resistance to creating a wildlife preserve?
I think what you're seeing with the Headwaters effort is a wariness of federal government and a desire to make sure that land is available for recreational enjoyment, while at the same time that land is protected for the sake of the Everglades and for the sake of our drinking water.
Well, I'm sure this is an issue that isn't going to be going away anytime soon. I've been speaking with Intersection Assistant Producer Amy Green, who did reporting on the Everglades and also on this effort to create a new wildlife preserve at the headwaters of the Everglades. Amy, thanks so much.
Glad to be here.
You can find out more about Everglades restoration and photography of Clyde Butcher online at WMFE.org/intersection. Lastly, we'll talk with the director and actors behind the Orlando Shakespeare Theater's production of the children's story Miss Nelson is Missing on 90.7 WMFE-FM Orlando. The students of Room 207 were the worst behaved in school until their teacher, Miss Nelson, was replaced by Viola Swamp, the meanest substitute ever. And Orlando Shakespeare Theater's latest play brings to life the classic children's picture book, Miss Nelson is Missing, runs through November 19th. And I'm happy to be joined in the studio by actors Amanda Lakey. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
And Amanda is both Miss Nelson and Viola Swamp in the play. Rudy Rushdie.
Thank you.
Also with us is Steve McKinnon, who is this play's director.
Hi, nice to be here.
Good to have you all with us. So Miss Nelson is part of Orlando Shakespeare Theater series of plays that run for children specifically. The company has performed plays like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs this summer and plans to perform Charlotte's Web next spring. So you've got this whole run of kind of classic children's tales. Steve, how did you decide on doing Miss Nelson is Missing?
Well, actually, the Orlando Shakespeare Theater contacted me as a freelance director to come in and direct their show, to actually direct it and music direct it. So when they gave me the offer, it was a project that I was really close to as being a kid knowing the story, so I decided I'd love to be involved with it.
Do you have to approach doing work for children different than for adults?
Yes, you do. You definitely want to keep kids engaged a certain way while still keeping the integrity of the story and the acting and keeping it honest. But you always want to kind of explore different ways to tell the story, keep the kids' attention, and just new ways to tell a story, because especially nowadays with TV and internet, kids' attention spans are so fast. So you really keep them engaged is kind of a challenge, but it's fun.
So how do you do it in the play?
With our actors is first and foremost pretty much. Our actors are really playing some great characters. They play really broad strokes, and their characterizations really kind of have an edge to them. They're real fun. They're quirky. We also bring that story to life with the way the way it looks with visually, comedy and music. So all that, those kind of elements different combined really engages the, you know, the kids and the audience to watch the story and be involved.
So Amanda and Rudy, you both have to wear multiple hats in this play. And Amanda, you've got the lead character who almost is a little bipolar in yeah. some ways. So talk to me a little bit about that. How do you make it happen?
Oh, wow. Well, Miss Nelson is definitely a complete opposite of Miss Viola Swamp. She's really on both ends of the spectrum. So you've got the sweet, nice, kind third grade teacher, Miss Nelson. Well, when her class is terrible and they're mean and they're not paying attention and they're being boisterous, she decides that something has to be done, and she turns into this mean, nasty witch teacher, Miss Swamp, and whips them into shape.
So how do you accomplish that on the stage?
It took a lot. It took a lot, actually, because I'm not used to being so mean to people and being so, like, heavy-handed. And Steve really, he would, like, not yell at me, but really pound it into me, being like, you need to be more nasty and you need to growl at them. So trying out different vocal levels and really being able to pull in more acting chops into that sort of mix. But kind of like Miss Nelson, she's more of a sweet Disney princess and just being very light and airy. And her counterpart is just nasty.
Well, give us some Miss Swamp.
You want some Miss Swamp?
Yes. I want more.
Would you like a line from the show?
Sure, yeah.
All right. Not so fast. Pipe down in your seats. Now.
But that's enough to put me back in my seat. Listening to that. So, Amanda, you wear those multiple hats in the show. Rudy, how about yourself?
I play three different characters in the show. I play Pop Hansen, which is the narrator of the show and kind of the school janitor, the pop of the school, if you would. And then also Principal Blandsworth, who is...
that is a very principal-sounding name.
Yeah. he's kind of the boring principal that's kind of... the party pooper that comes in and, you know.
I want to hear that.
You want to hear that one?
Let's hear the principal. I want to see if it relates back to what I remember.
Good morning, children. Now, let's all have our seats like good boys and girls. I'm afraid I have some bad news for you. Miss Nelson will not be coming in today, but she will be sending in a substitute, and from what I understand, it's someone very special.
Well, so he's in on this.
Yeah, he knows a little bit, and so does Pop, too, I think. I think it's because the class has gotten out of hand, and Miss Nelson's at her wit's end, and she kind of, I think Pop and Blandsworth are giving their graces to go ahead and go through with this little scheme.
Well, I like hearing about that. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. We're talking about Miss Nelson is Missing, the latest play from Orlando Shakespeare Theater. I'm Mark Simpson. Of course, if you're not familiar with it, Miss Nelson is Missing is a great children's book, and these guys are really bringing it back because my mother used to read it to me. So I'm feeling my childhood coming back. Have you read Miss Nelson is Missing? Let us know what you think on Facebook or Twitter. You can send an email over to intersection@WMFE.org. So I wonder, Steve, when you think about this play and Miss Nelson is Missing, does it ever cross your mind that if this was to happen in a real school in today's environment, Miss Nelson would be out the door?
Yeah, she'd be fired pretty quickly, I think. But I think because the teachers and her coworkers are in on it, I think that's part of it. But she does get pretty intense with the kids, especially she's got a little physicalization. She likes to smack that ruler really hard. So it's pretty scary. And even in the show, sometimes you see the kids get a little freaked out. Yeah.
Tell me, Amanda and Rudy, a little bit about your own acting background and how did you get involved with this production?
I am actually from Atlanta, Georgia. I just graduated with my BA in theater from the Gainesville Theater Alliance, and I got this job through a conference called the Southeastern Theater Conference, which takes place every March, I believe, anywhere in tons of cities down in the Southeast. And I auditioned actually with Lisa, and A week later, I got a call, and they said, we want you to be an acting education intern.
So what does it mean to get something like that for you at this early stage in your career?
It's a great continuation. It's a kind of a bridge between, a great bridge between finishing your BA or BFA and getting into the professional world, because you are working with very talented, professionals in the Orlando community, like Philip Nolan and Steve McKinnon. We're taking classes with Jim Helsinger, the artistic director, and Ann Herring, who's also a adjunct faculty at a couple universities around here. So you're still getting the training in and stuff like that.
And Amanda, for you, where does this come in your acting career?
Well, I just graduated from Rollins College, which is just right around the corner. I got my BA in theater with an emphasis in performance. And so having this, like Rudy said, having this right after graduating is a blessing there, because of the whole job market out there now, and just being able to be an intern and getting to do what I love and work in my profession is so rewarding, and it's unbelievable.
What's your favorite thing about being in the play?
In this play? I get to be someone I'm completely not, which is awesome. Being able to play put those masks on and really just be crazy and be kooky and not care what people think.
And what about for you, Rudy?
I always get a kick out of doing children's theater specifically because it's, you really see some of those kids light up, and you see, kids that are sometimes being, sometimes their creativity and stuff might be a little more stifled once they start getting into like middle school or high school, and seeing them break out of that a little bit and realize that you can be a functioning member of society and be eccentric and crazy and still make people laugh is, I think, really important.
Steve, is this play targeted at a specific age group, or is this, good for teenagers all the way through up through adults?
It's definitely targeted for, I think, elementary age, and an adult audience as well. I think we've had middle school and high school kids there, and they enjoy it, and they laugh right along with the adults. But we definitely, a lot of our shows are field trips, and it's geared for the elementary age.
Well, Amanda, I wonder if you could take us out maybe with a message either from Miss Nelson or Viola Swamp, or maybe both. Or how do you?
She sings too very well.
Now, wait, who do you sing as? Do you sing as,
I sing as both?
You sing as both. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. It's always nice to end on a musical note. This is Amanda Lakey singing as Viola Swamp.
One small slip, that's it, kiddies. I'm meaner than a snake when you are bad. So for heaven's sake, don't make me mad when I get through your wish you've had. Miss Nelson, school is not a romp, is it?
No.
Woe to those who misbehave.
Wow, you've got a set of lungs there. That is fantastic. That is fantastic. Amanda Lakey plays Miss Nelson and Viola Swamp in the play Miss Nelson is Missing. Also, we are joined by Rudy Rushdie, who performs a number of roles in the performance. And also, we are joined by Steve McKinnon, who is directing the play Miss Nelson is Missing with the Orlando Shakespeare Theater. Guys, thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Find out more about what's happening on Intersection at the WMFE Facebook and Twitter pages, or visit WMFE.org/intersection, where you can download our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.